All right, well, today we get to end our series that about the Ten Commandments. God speaks words for then and now, and so you can be turning in Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, verse 18 is where we'll be picking up and looking at here in just a moment. The other day, Amy and I, we in our new neighborhood where we're at, we've had the privilege of kind of getting back to our walking schedule, and we get to get up early in the morning and walk, and we try to do it daily. Doesn't always work out every day, but partly too because of our schedule. Right now, at least most of the time, it's in the dark, and so we're walking the neighborhood. We're unfamiliar with the neighborhood, and as we're making our way through the one of our first trips and trying out the new potential areas and stuff, we don't know where all the dogs are and all the pitfalls you might want to avoid. Daryl took me on a tour and kind of gave me, it was too long of a tour though, he walks way too long. So I kind of got familiar with some of those areas. But anyway, as we're walking through, it's dark and I do have a little stick I'm walking with, and then all of a sudden, you know, just off to the side, we hear that, you know, that growl and that run coming straight at us, and here comes that, you know, loud bark, and Audrey, you know what I'm talking about. I have a fear of dogs, you know. You remember that, right? So I'm picking on her because actually her dog bit me when I was 10 years old. I've never confessed it, but I'm going to go ahead and tell it because that happened when I was 10 years old. She actually was visiting my grandparents, and I was playing with her Dachshund, and later on I put my face in front of that dog, and it snipped me, and I still have the scar. So I ever since then I have this, you know, fear of dogs. So anyway, in that I hear that dog rushing and it's coming at us, and Amy's getting tense, of course, and I'm trying to figure out if I should push her toward the dog or if I should, you know, but I decide to be bold and I try to, you know, man up, and then of course there's a fence, but we couldn't see the fence in the dark, and the dog stops dead, hits the fence, and is just making a bunch of racket. But isn't that kind of really what we always love to have, is some kind of barrier between ourselves and what it is we fear? You know, in essence, that's exactly when we look at the Ten Commandments, this latter part, that's really what we're seeing. When they hear God speak and they've heard the commandments, they actually become so covered in fear. And often when we do read fear in Hebrew particularly, there's that awe factor involved. The fear here has certainly got an awe factor to it, but it is true trembling fear, and it's so much so that, again, they want something between them and this fierce God that they have now been introduced to. And so today, when you look, that's exactly what we're going to see. And again, as we prepare the read, you may stand with me. Chapter 20, verse 18. Remember the context. Again, the people have gathered. It's God's people who he has gathered before them on the mountain. But the mountain is shaking with his presence. The lightning and the thunder is roaring. And they have now heard the Ten Commandments. And then in verse 18, we pick up. It says, "Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled. And they stood far off and said to Moses, 'You speak to us and we will listen. But do not let God speak to us, lest we die.' Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin.' People stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was." Amen. You may be seated. Again, for us, because we're so removed from that event, it's sometimes easy for us to read that and go, how silly. But in all reality, how often do we react in the same way? In fact, it's really what we do every time we find ourselves being convicted of sin, because that is, in essence, a drawing us to the reality of who God is and revealing the reality of who we are. And then how do we react to conviction? We often, what, want to remove ourselves from that potential conviction. We want to remove ourselves from where that source might be, or we want to remove ourselves from having to hear any more of it. And we want that distance. We want that distance between the reality so that we can continue to live in the delusion. And so this reaction is not unusual in that way. In fact, it's a very common reaction. In fact, I would even go so far to say it is the proper reaction for a man or woman to have before God. And I think as we see here, as they're crying out and they say that they're looking for Moses to intervene, to be that mediator, to be that safety between God and themselves, and they're begging now Moses, hey, take that position. You know, go ahead. You talk to God. You bring us His words, but we don't want to have that one-on-one personal interaction with Him right now. And why is that? Because, again, what has happened? They've gone through those Ten Commandments. They've heard them. They heard them so much better than we've heard them. But yet, even in what we've heard, we've been able to, hopefully, rightfully, I know I have, and I believe you have, assess that we fail every one of them. And if that's the standard, and it is, then what do? We're hopeless. And that's what they're basically noting. We're hopeless. We have nothing. Look how they even refer. They say, hey, Moses in verse 19, you speak to us. We'll listen to you. Just tell us what to do, but you speak to us. But don't let God speak. Otherwise, we'll die. If He speaks directly to us, He'll see the reality of our sin. He'll see the broken commandments littered across the landscape of our life, and we'll die. And so their cry out is for a mediator. And then, of course, Moses steps up and he says, hey, wait a second. I know this is harsh. I know this is hard. But don't miss it. Don't fear this God. Because remember, this God has beckoned you and called you. This God has rescued you from your entrapment and enslavement. God has come, as He says, to test you. He's given you a test. That the fear of Him may be before you. That you'll never forget this moment of real conviction, real insight into your heart. That you'll use this moment to continue forward without continuing in sin. In essence, it's a pop test. I know in school I've hated those because, you know, needless to say, you're never prepared, right? It's a pop test. And it's a pop test, you're guaranteed to fail. That's what they are. That's what the Ten Commandments are. It won't matter what day we apply them. It won't really matter what minute of the day we apply them. We will find ourselves failing. And yet it's a test with a purpose. It's a test to not actually draw us, to push us away. It's actually a test to draw us to Him. Because as they have said, they need a mediator. They need someone between them and God. And Moses has taken on that temporary position. And we see that play out now over their history and their life and their time. And we see that begin to play out in the fulfilling of the law as it's declared of how to worship and how to go about their daily activities. The fullness of the whole law begins to display. Here's this mediator, and the law takes a mediating position, so to speak. The religious practices take a mediating position, but each and every one of those are temporary positions. Temporary because they can offer no eternal hope. In fact, they're only there to remind us constantly of our desperate need. Again, what was Moses always doing as he was going back and forth? He's coming back with more law where you'll fail, more law where you'll err. And he's coming back and forth constantly, in essence, educating them on their failure. So where is our hope? Where is our opportunity to actually have any chance of redemption? Well, we see that in John. We'll actually turn to John chapter 14. John chapter 14, and let's look at, again, what I hope most everyone here will immediately be able to understand who is our mediator. It is Jesus Christ. Who was the mediator planned from the beginning of time? Jesus Christ. And so, let's see how Jesus Christ begins to declare what we must do and how we must do in relation to the Ten Commandments. John chapter 14, and I want to pick up right at verse 15. John chapter 14, verse 15. So what do we do with these commandments? How do we go about commandment living? Well, he declares right up front, he says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Well, wait a second, that is the problem. That is the problem. Now, all of this is taking place, and what we're about to read through and look at is what is the farewell discourse, the beginning passages of that. Jesus has already had to pass over and basically begin to really help the disciples understand a change is coming, and that change is coming through his death. And they're struggling to grasp it, and this is those last moments of where he's really driving home all of his teaching over the years, and he's trying to package it up and giving it to them in a real simple fashion. But it's also real deep, too, because he's piling it on. This is their last opportunity to learn from him directly in this way. And so as he's declaring some of these things, there's confusion, and we'll look at that in a moment too. But he's declaring this. He says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And yet when we look at the way he declares the commandments, as we've been doing, the commandments were bad enough just stuck in the Old Testament. Extrapolate them out into the New Testament, and they are truly the impossible. And yet he's still saying that the keeping of the commandments is central. If you love me, keep my commandments. Now, we actually read that often, and sometimes we think, oh, yeah, absolutely. I love Jesus, therefore I keep the commandments. And yet what he's saying is, if you don't keep the commandments, you can't say you love me. Well, if I know for a fact, and I'm honest, and allow the Holy Spirit to process that out and point to the reality of I don't keep the commandments, by virtue, what that's telling me is that I have a problem not with commandment keeping, with loving Jesus. And now here's what often we'll do as we begin to realize that. We'll get really concerned, and we'll get really pumped up about trying to make sure we keep the commandments. Remember how we've talked about it at different points. We like to create a checklist that we can kind of say, oh, yeah, I did that, I did that, I did that. I read my Bible. I went to church. I'm okay. I kept the commandments. So we won't have to deal with the issue that, wait a second, no, you really didn't. And it's not a commandment issue, it's a love issue. And Jesus is immediately declaring this. He's actually even helping them to understand how central it is. Don't even think that you can serve me. Don't even think you know me if you don't keep my commandments. If you look down in verse 23 there, he continues that same kind of thought, comes back to it. This is actually in response to Judas's, not Iscariot. It says, Lord, how is this that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? And Jesus answers. He says, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. And again, how wonderful that sounds. But yet he also continues and he says this other. Whoever does not love me does not keep my words. So if we could actually back up and just for a moment think about our day-to-day activities and the time periods where we are struggling, and maybe we had our boo-boo. Not really a boo-boo, because it's just sin. Because it's a breaking of a commandment. And if we actually were to look at that and begin to realize, wait a second, when I break the commandment, what I am now declaring in breaking the commandment is, I don't love you, Jesus. And so only when I am keeping the commandment would I be able to say, I actually love you, Jesus. And that's actually the reality of what our life is playing out bit by bit, moment by moment. You remember the thing, we've seen it in various stories and stuff, the young girl who is smitten with some young boy and she picks the flower. He loves me. He loves me not. He loves me. He loves me not. You know, we live our life sometimes, I love him. I love him not. I love him. I love him not. And so this is where it all begins to break down. What do we do with this issue then? Well, again, what is the purpose of all of this is to help us to remember we need a mediator. We are desperate for a mediator. So much so that, again, Jesus is declaring of that prior to, if you go up to the very first part of chapter 14, verse 1. Now, this is directly after he's told Peter that he is going to deny him. And so, needless to say, Peter's a little disturbed. The disciples are a little disturbed as they're trying to really grasp to the whole of this. Judas has already walked out. Everything's kind of like in chaos, and they're trying to get their mind wrapped around all that is unfolding here in these next few hours. And he says, let not your hearts be troubled. Let not your hearts be troubled. Well, see, here's one of our biggest problems, I believe, in the modern church today. Our hearts are not troubled with our condition of sin. So we even read through that and go, yeah, I don't need to worry about my job. That has nothing to do with your position. Let not your hearts be troubled. He says, believe in God, believe also in me. You believe in God, therefore you are bound to also have to believe in me. You can't separate me from the Father. And so you have to understand if you are struggling to believe in God, well, that's going to all center in on how you believe in me. He says, in my Father's house are many rooms. Again, we hear this often in funerals. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. You know the way to where I am going. And he's actually given him this wonderful, great promise, this beautiful promise. He's using the picture of the way that they did their marriage. That again, as a groom would then find his to be bride and begin to make it official. One of the things that he would then do is, in that sense, he would say, okay, I'm going to come back and get you at some point in the future. And meanwhile, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to my Father's house, because they didn't go out and start anew in their own place. I'm going to build a room. And that's going to be our room. And every day when you're walking by and you see me sweating and working and building that room, you know I'm going to keep that promise. I'm coming for you. Don't be troubled. Don't get caught up and overly concerned. I'm here and I'm not abandoning you. Though there's a time period of waiting. And it's a beautiful picture. And he's telling the disciples this. He's saying, look, you bet, I'm about to leave. And you're going to want to get overly concerned. But look, I'm going to prepare a place. And he says, you know the way where I am going. Well, Thomas immediately, he says, what? No, Lord, where are you going? We don't know what you're talking about. How can we know the way? We don't even know where you're going. And then Jesus utters what is, again, some of the greatest truth within the Bible. He says that I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. In essence, he's saying, you don't even have to worry about where I'm going. What you have to do is worry about, are you attached with me? Because I am the avenue, the way. I am the means. Well, also, truthfully, he's the end. So he is where, in essence, where are you going? You're going to him. And also, he's the means of getting there as well. Another way is actually to think through. He's saying, I am the way because I am the truth. And I am the truth because I am the life. There is no life without me. And he says, you can't get to heaven. You can't get to my Father. You can't get to God. You can't do anything other than die in your sins unless you come through me. He says, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. For now, you do know him and you have seen. Well, Philip's response is, wait a second. You know, if you just show us, you know, God, we'd be content with that. That's good enough. It's enough for us. He's like, have I been with you so long and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on account of the works themselves. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever believes in me will also do the works that I do, and greater works than these will he do, because I am going to the Father. And whatever you ask in my name, this I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it. And he's basically trying to take his disciples and going, come on, guys, let's think through everything I've told you, everything we've been going over, everything you've seen, everything you've done. Let's start putting the pieces together because it's now, it's crucial time. It's the moment it begins to count. I'm not going to be here to fill in the blanks for you. I am the Father, and the Father is in me. And that is a connection that cannot be broken. You've got it all mixed up in your head. And then he's like, he comes down and he says, look, guys, let's just put it this way. Just ask. Identify your need and ask. See your desperateness and ask. And I will do it. Again, one of our problems is we take that verse and we go, whatever you ask in my name, this I will do. Well, my goodness, I need a new car. And all I got to do is slap Jesus on the back end of that, and I get it. Right? I mean, that's kind of what it says. No, because the key critical thing he says is in my name, and he's not talking about stick his name on the back end of it. He's talking about in the fullness of who he is and what he represents and all of that that it encompasses. In essence, when you get yourself into me, you'll never have to worry about anything else. Because then your mind, your heart, your perspective, all will be where it needs to be. But then as he unfolds and he gets back to where we started, it says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. But see, that's the problem. That's what I wake up every day knowing that that's where my problem is. Okay, it's like I can intuitively work through this and understand, okay, you are the way, you are the truth, you are the life. And yet, but here, I'm not loving you because I'm not keeping the commandments the way I should. I don't find myself, again, perfecting this. There's not one of them I can ever get through a day and really say, oh, I did it, I made it. And if that's the case, then I'm not loving you. And I can't separate that truth either. So here's the problem, and here's what we end up doing, and this is where one of our major flaws in the way that we speak and articulate some of this. We believe that our salvation is contingent upon our ability to love Him. And yet, what we see when we read that is guess what? We don't love Him enough. We don't love Him always. I mean, we even understand that in what it says in Deuteronomy, right? And again, we know it's listed as the great commandment, to love God with all our heart, all our mind, all our strength. I mean, that one commandment alone destroys us. I can look over my 48 years and I don't even know if I've got a second in my life that I've really done that. Not for a moment have I fully done that. Well, here's what I'm excited about. I know there's coming a day. That's exactly what I'll do for all of eternity. He's promised me that. There's going to come a day where I will love Him with all my heart. Because I will have that totally transformed new heart without any impediments of sin. I will love Him with my mind. It will be totally geared and focused to Him, and nothing else will distract. And all of my strength, everything that encompasses who I am, and all of my abilities will be geared to that one truth. And I will live it out for eternity. I'm excited about that day. I long for that day. But you know what? I'm not there today. So I still have this problem. If my love is not enough because my love fails and is insufficient, then what do I depend upon? Well, here's how we have to correct how we think. It's Him loving us. That's where our hope is. That's the reality of what we are in desperate need of. It's not to somehow empower ourselves to do something. Because again, we'll do it for a moment, and then we'll fail for a moment. So again, if it's in us, if our salvation is somehow going to be dependent on, can I love enough? Can I keep the commandments well enough? Can I go to church enough? Can I read enough? Can I do this? Whatever it is, can I do it enough? Well, the answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's our desperate situation. But here's the question. Can He love me enough? Absolutely. He can love me today. He can love me tomorrow. He can love me though my past is there. He can love me regardless. It's kind of like a Dr. Seuss thing with green eggs and ham, right? He can love me on a house. He can love me with a mouse. He can love me all the time. That's what is so astonishing. He loves me. That is the great mediator. He loves me. Because where I cannot, He does. And He promises to build me into the one who can. He promises to make me into the image of His own Son. That I can love Him the way His Son loved the Father. That I can love like that. Well, you know, I'm not the only one who struggled. Actually, Paul struggled a lot, and you can look in Romans chapter 7. And one of the things that I so appreciate about Paul is just the very fact of him being real. He didn't have to. He didn't have to get into his own area of struggle. He could have kept writing through to the Romans and just glossed right over that and never brought it up. He could have let just his other letters and his other writings just stand on their own. And again, where he might occasionally kind of pinpoint and kind of say something kind of like, yeah, I've got some problems. You know, I call myself a chief of sinners. He didn't really have to go into a real dialogue about it, but he does. And I'm so glad, because then when I read what he has written there, I go, oh, Lord, there I am. There I am. Romans chapter 7, we'll pick up at verse 7. Just allow me to read through this and work to follow with me, because again, it does get a little kind of crazy trying to follow the line of thinking as he writes it out. But what then shall we say? That the law is sin? By no means. Yet if had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. For I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, it produced in me all kinds of covetousness. For apart from the law, sin lies dead. I was once alive apart from the law. But when the commandment came, sin came alive and I died. The very commandment that promised life proved to be death to me. For sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, deceived me and through it killed me. So the law is holy, and the commandment is holy, and righteous, and good. Did that which is good then bring death to me? By no means. It was sin producing death in me through what is good, in order that sin might be shown to be sin, and through the commandment might become sinful beyond measure. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I'm of the flesh, sold under sin. For I do not understand my own actions. For I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it is good. So now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me. That is, in my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep on doing. Now, if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. So I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God, in my inner being. But I see in my members another law waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then I myself serve the law of God with my mind, but with my flesh I serve the law of sin. Amen. Who will deliver us from this wretchedness? Who will cease this sin? I can't do it in my strength. I can't do it in my abilities. Again, I have to be just like what Paul says here, that I know that nothing good dwells in me. And when I look at the commandments, like verse 10 says, I see the commandments and they seem to hold promise, and yet what they do is they prove death to me. And I'm in a hopeless state. Even on this side of grace. That's one of the great scholarly debates. Is Paul writing this as a where he would be noting an unbeliever, or is he noting a believer? Is he talking about himself or someone else? I believe he's, again, declaring his very own heart of the very struggle it is to live out the reality of what we're called to live under grace. There's the struggle. Because again, here's the reality. First off, if you don't know Christ, you don't care about this. It's the least of your concerns. You're certainly not concerned with doing good. So the very fact that he's struggling here and he's noting it again, I believe, says this is that type of struggle. But then as he comes, he begins to narrow it down, and he realizes that everything he's saying, everything that he's talking about, it leaves one final conclusion, that I am a wretched man. I don't know if you have the Ten Commandments on your wall at home or posted anywhere, but if you read them, the reality of what they ought to be communicating to you is that you are a wretched person. And when we can read them in any other way, we are living a lie and deluding ourselves. Because it ought to be doing exactly what it's doing here to Paul. Wretched man that I am, and here I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? And there is only one. There is only one mediator. There is only one hope. There is only one salvation, and it is in Jesus Christ and in Jesus Christ alone. And I have nothing else but to be a person of total dependence upon Jesus Christ and his death, burial, and resurrection. So again, here's our problem. Every one of us uses a mediator. And it doesn't matter saved or unsaved in this situation. Every one of us uses a mediator. Every one of us puts some barrier between us and God. It may be a fence. It may be your parents. It may be your religious duties. It may be a variety of things. Just take your pick. But every one of those mediators will fail. And only one mediator can actually stand. And that's Jesus Christ. And here's the reason, because only one mediator is actually going to be able to stand before God and say, I kept every one, every day, every moment, without fail. And then, I gladly took every sin, every one, from every moment, without fail. And Father, I am willing to take the righteousness that I earned and that I displayed, and I am willing to give it to this one who is unrighteous. And I will take their sin. So God, Father, when you look at me, see them. When you look at them, see me. That is the exchange that he offers every single one of us. That is the exchange that makes a difference and begins to make commandment living even possible. Because see, when we actually recognize that kind of exchange, when we quit thinking somehow we earned it, somehow we did something to justify God wanting us on his team. When we start to realize that, again, it was simply God and God alone loving us, then all of a sudden, the response, the natural response for us is to love him. And then the commandments, what used to be chains, which used to be death, they actually become glory because they become the greatest way and avenue that we can display our love toward him. So much so that in Psalm 19, verse 7, I love how the psalmist here, and that noted to be David, he's writing about the law. His expression of what the law is so much different than ours. Even today, what do? We kind of want to just shove the law off to the side and just talk about grace. But again, there is no grace without the reality of the judgment of the law. But yet, when we can experience the beauty of him loving us through Jesus Christ and surrendering ourselves to that truth and allowing that exchange to take place, that I'll take his righteousness and he can take my sin, then we can respond like this: the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is your servant warned, and keeping them there is great reward. So what is your view of the law? Is your view that it's glorious? Well, again, I think that's going to be tied to your view of Jesus Christ. Do you keep the commandments? Again, the honest confession is no. But I am thankful I know a commandment keeper. And I am thankful there was a commandment keeper willing to go to the cross for me, to take my commandment breaking to it and have it die there. That same offer is available to you. And I pray that you'll respond in kind, however that might be. As we come to a close again, if you desire and need, you need to discuss your situation before God, then again, I pray that you'll come forward and allow us to do so and prayerfully do that together. If you're needing a church home and desire to be a part of this church, I pray that you'll come forward and express that and we can talk about that. If you need to come forward and just pray, come and just pray. Whatever it is you need to do it today. Let's pray. Lord, again, we thank you for this time today. We thank you for being in your presence. And oh, Lord, how we thank you for loving us. Your mercy is endless. Your grace rolls like the waves and never ceases. Lord, the beauty of what you have given through your Son is beyond even our very understanding. But Lord, I pray that you'll speak to the hearts here as you've spoken to mine, to rejoice at what you have done, to rejoice in you loving us, and to rejoice in the law itself that never lets me forget my desperate need for your Son.